14 from Padmanabhan.
But we do it a little bit different than the Tina. So essentially the same. But before I do that, I wanted to mention explicitly something that you noticed on the questionnaire that we mentioned LaTeX, the mathematical typesetting. And from glancing through the questionnaires, it looks like a lot of you already know how to use it, at least somewhat. But since this is supposed to be a preparation for research course, you have to learn LaTeX. And the sooner you learn it, the happier you're going to be. So anybody, all those of you who are not so versed in it, are going to be getting practice if you take this class. No, I mean, it's not a whole lot, but we're going to require, we just had like at least two problem sets to be turned in that format. So we'll put help files up on the web page, and also sample tech files. Like I can put the tech for all the problem sets up, and so you can. This would be a very good excuse for learning anything that you don't know about tech. You're going to have to learn almost everyone here is a graduate student, so you're going to have to write something up in tech, one way or another. Unless, I mean, there's nobody here in planetary science, right? Because planetary science is actually, they do use words, but I know that's, yeah, it's something to laugh at, but it's their problem. So I was really amazed to learn that, actually. Icarus, the planetary science journal, is there. Actually, all their submissions are in Word. Strange. I mean, anyway, so write your solutions in tech a couple of times at least. But if you want to just practice and maybe write one of the solutions in tech each week or something like that, that's fine. You can turn them all into tech if you really want to. But we do want you to show all your steps and everything. So it's going to be a little bit excruciating, but it's like taking your test or whatever. Painful, but good for you. Anyway, so the problem that I'm going to introduce you to now is. Coming.
I don't know. Is this the astrophysics? Is it supposed to be?
Yeah, it got moved. Sorry. Because of the conference. Did you see the sign? Okay, there's a sign that's outside the door. In the bottom room. Did you try to come this morning and couldn't find us?
No, I didn't realize that. I forgot about this.
Okay, that's fine.
So do you want to give him the handouts?
Here, you can.
Okay.
Great,
thanks.
That's fine. All right, so this morning we learned about radiation, which is an obviously important thing. Very well explained. One of the other very important forces. Not that many, right? And there's only two that are relevant for us. For most of astrophysics and cosmology, there's only two that are relevant. And astronomy and weak nuclear forces, while very interesting forces, are not really relevant for most of astrophysics and cosmology, except for like inside of neutron stars and such. So, but for the most of the history of the universe, it's just the electromagnetic force and gravity. That's it. So gravity is the force we're going to talk about right now. And basically, the question is treating. If you learn in physics classes about treating like particles running off of each other, like with the electromagnetic force, this is what we're more familiar with because this is what we do every day. But from astrophysical scales, whenever there's stars and galaxies traipsing around, interacting with each other, they interact with each other via gravity, and they're big enough that even though gravity is weak, the forces between them are strong. And so basically the question we're going to address is classic physics question, which is just how do interactions between individual particles cause an ensemble of particles to change in time or relax? We're going to treat it in a gravitational context. So the treatment I'm going to give is very similar to the same treatment you would give for a bunch of charged particles interacting with each other under any charge or anything. So it's a very general sort of thing. So the question basically is that if you start out, and the question you will often be asking yourself is that you start out with a bunch of objects, a bunch of stars, say this is some region characterized by a size R, and and there's a bunch of these gravitating objects in it. Whether if you say there's, say, n of them, then you know that the number density of those is going to be something like, so a lot of times we're going to be really thinking secretly in our minds about things like galaxies, where you talk about not so much the number density, but the surface density, which is sort of the integrated number density over the over one of the dimensions. So basically just the, which is basically just the number per area. And it turns out to be an adequate thing here. So that's just here and over pi r squared. And so the question you want to ask in lots of astrophysical questions is, so you turn loose all of these stars, they got forms somehow. I'm not going to answer that question right now. And you want to say, how long is it going to take for these stars to forget their initial distribution of velocities and process each other just by running into each other gravitationally into some homogenized distribution that just has to do with the local potential that they determine rather than their initial conditions. So to do that, you just need to figure out basically how often they hit each other and what are hit each other, which in gravitational terms means just gravitating off of each other, and how much each of these collisions affects their behavior. And by behavior here, I really mean their velocity, because the initial conditions here are basically only just the momentum field, just the average velocity that these things are traveling at. And so, we'll take this general picture and we'll specialize down. This is wanting to float on me. Specialize down to a single star, and we treat it as sort of the perturbing stars. Like we're going to take one to be relatively fixed, or just work in a frame where this one is fixed. And think about another star that's shooting by. It doesn't have to be a star, but it could be a galaxy or any other object. But we're going to say star for now. So anyway, so this object is moving along with some velocity, and it's going to pass by this little star with a minimum approach, which we're going to call b, which is the impact parameter, should be fancy like. And so then, at a time t, at some time, it's going to be a distance r, little r, away from that star. Right. So the question is, so if we have stars interacting like this, what is the force or what influence will this passage have on the velocity of the star? Can somebody tell me, is it going to push it away? Is it going to deflect it up, down, this way, into the board? Yeah, obviously, right? This is not rocket science yet. So they're gonna have a net deflection down. And so what we really want to calculate is that net deflection down due to this force. Alright, so we can write down the force. So force of gravity, hope you all know, given by Newton's constant. And if we just take both of these to be the same mass for now, easy enough, I mean, it's simple enough. So we given by that, divided by the square of the distance. Right? And for the signs, I'm not gonna worry about that. Obviously, it's an attractive potential, so it's usually written. Attractive force is usually written with a negative sign, that sort of thing. But we don't have to really worry about that for the purposes of this. And now what we have to do is decide on the system of coordinates. Basically what we're going to call is this, if we take this to be the x direction, y direction, then r will be given by x squared plus r squared. Right? And so that's, so the total force will be given by, critically, E squared. Because this is, we're going to just take, for now, the distance, the impact current for space, and just look at the single trajectory going by. So that's fine. But what we really want, so that'll give us, so this will be related to the total acceleration from this. So as it gets closer, it'll be speeding up, and then as it goes farther away, it'll be slowing down, right? And because it'll be rolling into and out of the central well. I didn't really care about that process because we figured that's going to balance out. On average, the velocity increase and decrease will be enough. So what we really are curious about is not so much the total, but the perpendicular part of the force, part of the force directed downward. At every time, that force is going to be given by the total force times the cosine of theta. Find that's right. Okay, is that the right theta for this? Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I just suddenly remember how to find theta before. And then, but then cosine of theta in terms of these things is just E over R, which is V over X squared plus E squared. Right? Now, you can correct me if I make some mistakes putting off squared. You know this. Anyway, and so then we're almost done. So we know the force at any particular time, x, where we're writing here x, the function of time. Right. And so we just need to have some formula for this, and we all remember that for something moving in uniform straight line direction, this is a pretty simple formula. Basically, the initial x plus the and so if we just take x0, so that t equals 0, whatever we call that, have x equal 0. So we determine that one free parameter. And that means basically that we're taking our origin in time to be the moment of closest approach. This is pretty straightforward. But that's what that gives us, though, is a nice formula for x as a function of time. So for negative time, we have a negative distance. And for positive time, positives. So now we're almost there, getting this force. So basically, then we just have to say that you have Newton's law, x equals ma, but then we don't really want the whole thing. We just want the perpendicular part gives made perpendicular. But then a perpendicular really is just the time rate of change of the perpendicular part. The change is the velocity, right? So now we have a nice formula to solve, which is m delta v dot. Oftentimes when you use the notation where a dot indicates the time derivative, most of you aren't sure of this. Leibniz notation, this is Newton's the dot size. Dot is the only one, Newton had a whole set of these things. Dot, I think, is the only one that survived, but he had like some crazy, the new unit is better than I have. Like with equal signs with dots around them. And, whole system of strange things. Strange guy. So this is equal to f perp, which is equal to gm squared over x squared, which is g squared over and then we can plug in x equals vt,
into this. And then it can be a seat. By trying to by M and taking out a back. Isolate because we're going to want to integrate over time here in a second. So we're going to want to isolate this so we can change variables. We're going to pull out the factor of B. So now we're done. I mean, now we're not done. We're almost. We're here. Yeah.
Good question. Why x x is vt? We have like the force in x direction anyway. Mm-hmm. We don't have only
right. Well, we're just assuming that's going to be small. And it's going to average out. So this is obviously to do it exactly correctly.
So like we can see this bike only on the both near the.
So we're going to assume basically that this impact parameter is large enough, so that taking the undisturbed path is decent across. Or that'll be a constraint soon that we're going to impose to make sure to keep internal consistency. It's a perfectly good question. It's an excellent question because there's a whole class of paths here. But this will not be a good approximation. But you get really close in this term, right? And then this is a really terrible one. But we're going to assume that B is larger than some minimum, which we're going to determine in a minute.
Yeah. But we're trying to find the relaxation time, essentially, right? So we should be taking the case where it's close, like the first case.
Yeah, so you can do both. It turns out that the sum of all the little, because they're basically just because there's so much more space where you undergo these more distant interactions, those add up to be more than all of the close interactions, just because sort of the your target. So basically, if you think about it, sort of if this is your whole, let's just turn this on its side and look at it from the perspective of the car star going through. So you have all of your little target stars here. So this is this is some stuff. This is your size scale, 2R or R. The question is. For each one of these little stars, there's some little circle that's the radius for the circle in which you would have to pass to get a substantial kick from that individual star. And it turns out we can demonstrate this
if we have time.
It turns out that if you hit these sufficiently rarely, that you get more of an effect from just summing over all the different ones you pass, not very close to, but they give us some. Each one gives a little kick, and the sum of all the little kicks is bigger than this than the rare big hits. Basically, just because the number is so large, and that would not remain true if it became a very dense big one. But for these problems, it turns out. That's a good question. And it would be if you're thinking about like a plasma and you have electrons going in or something like that, then this is not necessarily the case. But it's always something you have to calculate. You always have to look for any particular system, whether the sum of the long range or interactions is greater than or less than the rare, the somewhat rare direct cutoff. Good question. Alexander? I'm going to assert for now because this is more important. Okay. Any other questions this one? Okay. Right, so we have this formula. I can solve it for so basically this relation to be D delta.
And so then, so just delta V as a function of V. Now, remember that we've implicitly, this velocity is a function of time and V. It's like dV t is a function of time and impact parameter, right? Because we just assumed some particular impact parameter. But we're going to have to assume some over all the different impact parameters, all the different incorrect parameters. But first, we can do this. So this is going to be the integral over time. Gm v squared. Right? And so we're taking velocity to be constant for now, taking obviously g and m to be constant. So we just change, we can change variables to s, say, where s is vt v, then get s equals v over v dt, and we have an overall three factor. Dimensionless integral from which we can take to go from all time for simplicity over 1 over 1 plus s squared halves. Turns out this integral just gives 2. And no, that's right. Anyway, so that means that the numerical force of this is just 2 gm over dv. So this is the first important result. For one passage of one star going by one other star, then this the net change will be given by this formula. So long as subject to the provision that delta V per over V is considerably less than 1. Which is basically the assumption that we didn't have one of the near encounters that would cause this approximation to break. So this, by the way, this is doing this kind of calculation is not what you, like whenever we get trained in the process, we usually don't do this kind of approximations where it's like, this is not the exact answer. Because we, I mean, the thing is we know that you probably could get the exact answer. We can just calculate this and spend time and get the whole full general solution. But the point is, and this is true for, just to continue on the AHS theme in the morning of talking about research, but throughout much of the actual research that people do, what one of the key insights that you always that you make in a problem is realizing when you can do a calculation like this, a simple one, begins a real intuition, which is, and then use that to get further results, which we're going to proceed to do. And the real insight here is right is that, you know, I mean, this is we could have probably guessed this without doing all this calculation. It's going to be, the change is going to be governed by the mass. Bigger mass is going to bigger effect. The inverse to how far away it makes sense. And the inverse to the velocity, right? Because basically, what we can rewrite this as is that if we have, so the force that closest approach is going to be gm squared over b squared, right? And then the time that force endures to just construct it dimensionlessly is going to be basically v divided by v, right? So the velocity is only, this is the only dimensionally correct combination we can do. And so the impulse will get up f dt will just be this times this on gm squared over dv, which is exactly this. Up to a factor of 2. So I did all this work to get a factor of 2. And this, of course, this is, and this is even in the crude approximation. But the point is that you can get the basic answer very quickly with a back in the loop style approximation. You can check it with something like this, which is a little bit better. And then you can just proceed. You don't have to worry about spending a week finding the exact integral representation, all possible curves of two famous volumes. Does that make sense? Anyway, so this is sort of the sort of trick that the better you get at it, the happier you're going to be. Because you get quickly to understanding the physics of what's going on. And don't spend so much time puzzling over mathematical details that, while important, in the end, don't really aid your intuition. But this is just part of the story. We had to get the force and how that force changes the velocity. But now we have to figure out how all these little velocity changes add up over time. Basically, to get that, we need to know something about how frequently these events happen. This is when we're going to come back to this number thing. We can just start here. So basically, since we calculate the way we decided to approach this is to take our star and send it into the board. Cross is usually into the board or out.
Into,
okay. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, but I'll just get that. So we're going to take this, and we've calculated what the force of a star and our distance b from that is. But obviously, that's the area of a circle of zero. So we're going to widen that circle into a ring by adding the width dB. dB. And so the area of a ring, which is basically the ring of the points that we're going to consider at a time away from our star, is 2 pi dB. So then we just have to ask, now how often does this ring, as it passes through this collection of objects, hit one of those objects? And the answer is that it's just basically this area times the number per unit area, right? Which is why we started off by talking about this number per unit area thing. Because then you can directly use this kind of cross-section. This is why it's useful, because at any particular time it's passing through, how many are you going to see? So then you just say, so the for a single passage through, so so for a single passage through the number of times you hit it is going to be the number density per unit area per passage, right? Because that's right. So this is going to be really the number divided by the total volume times the length going through, which is really R2, right? So if you want to get you think of it sort of like as a kind of a cylinder. So as you go through, you're going to have a certain total number of objects and filling the area. And so the number that you pass by as you go through is going to be given by this. So you get that number times the area of your impact ring here. And then, so we can carry this along, but this is this point. This is going to be given by n r squared. And you can, the factors of pi are not going to really end up being relevant. It's not going to actually cancel out here, but you can make different approximations and end up with different numbers of factors here. So it's not really something to worry about. And then you just end up with 2n over r squared b. And you can see that this has the right units. So b and dB are lengths, r is lengths. Things drop out. That's how you know you have a pure number, which is the number of time to get it. You hit something per passage through the entire length of the galaxy. So by doing this, I'm explicitly going to just say it's like how many pass average times does an object to pass through the entire length of this galaxy or cluster or region before something interesting happens. Anyway, so this is the number. You see, it's going to depend on B again. And so then we just have to say, so what is the average change in perpendicular velocity per passage? Does anybody know the answer to that?
I'm thinking zero because there's equal chance of being in a point around circle.
Exactly. So the average change in velocity, first power, will be zero. So you might think, well, then why did we do all that effort? It's going to average. But that's not the only average you can perform, right? What, you can do what else?
Average of the square?
Average of the square, exactly. More like a random ball, where even though the average number fits on either direction will be zero, the sum will eventually sort of accumulate just by random variation. So that turns out to be the right thing to average. And so we can just do that simply by basically taking this to be just the number of transits times the number of hits per transit times delta v per squared per hit. And then we just, and that's going to be the average square of change in velocity. So if you write that down, this is going to be n, 2n, gn, sorry, 4n, gn squared over e squared, times e, 2i. Right? So for a given passage, the average squared velocity change, we're going to go like this. So then what we do is then just say, well, we're going to have to sum up over all the different impact parameters. Let me simplify that a little. So we can already see what kind of the integral this is going to be. But we have to decide what our area of integration will be. Or what our range of integration will be. And so the range of integration is going to have, so there's going to be two, so we're basically going to get the real change in v squared is going to be some integral over b times all of these factors and 1 over b. So we just need to figure out. So it would be a minimum and a maximum. So the max is probably easy to guess. It's going to be what?
Infinity.
That's not infinity. We have r. Right. There's only two things going here. So the minimum one, though, I've also already alluded to. Can someone tell me what the min will probably be? What will happen at dmin? What do I know about dv per at dmin probably?
So it'll be comparable to v per.
Exactly. So we'll just take that as a function. So delta v, this is equal to 2gm over dv. Whenever this is about as big as b, we know this approximation is really bad. It can be bad before this, but this is good enough. And so that, what that basically tells me is that d, so this will be the min, dp, all of the other things are constant. So b min will be given by d squared over 2 gm. Right? It's pretty simple algebra. So now we have our limits of integration. This going from here to the full size of the thing. bargaining factors. So then we're going to have overall
m squared.
Or v squared. And then the logarithm, so the integral of dv over v log. And that's be the logarithm of r over. All right. So now we know, in general, how what the total change in v will be per passage for all impact parameters. Most of the way through the problem now, actually. Because the number, and so we can, this makes sense. We can sort of make sense of this. So the change is going to be increased by a higher number density. Makes sense. It's always good to do in these sanity checks. And so the more massive objects are going to have a bigger change. If gravity were stronger, you have a bigger change. If the velocity were bigger, we'd have a weaker change. Because you go through faster, right? Okay, so this is the same sort of result. You know, that didn't do something egregiously wrong. Because, I mean, sometimes in physics you get crazy results and you're right. But whenever you're doing physics like this, sort of like, you should really worry if you get a non-intuitive result. So the passage between between being a student and being a researcher is sometimes trusting your crazy results. But you shouldn't trust all of your crazy results. All right, so we can do some, at this point though, we can start asking real questions like, how long is it going to take for these effects to accumulate is something important. So just remind you, this is per passage. But first I'm going to do a nice little simplification that you can virtually always do in these kind of gravitational system problems, or any kind of like lots of physical problems, which is you can apply the virial theorem. Simple to basically reduce the number of variables that you have. The virial theorem, many of you astrophysicists already probably know. Can someone state it for me?
Can you reduce two times the potential energy?
Up to a factor of four, you're right. The potential energy is twice the energy. That's right. Anyway, so this is what happens. This is something like effort partition of energy. There's this general principle that whenever a system gets calmed down, then it's going to be balancing its kinetic energy with its potential energy. This is sort of a deep statement about nature, but it's also just a really useful kind of fact. And in fact, you've learned today two of the formulas that are going to appear, and I cannot tell you how many talks throughout the rest of your career, because that the form or in problems and things is that this formula for the acceleration, the energy emitted by accelerating electrons, everywhere, unbelievably common. Like, if you memorize that, you should have that formula like burned into your brain, because it's going to appear in like random places. You aren't going to, it'll be like, it'll be sitting in some talk about X-ray plasmas. And then, of course, since all we ever measure is photons, you're going to apply, see that formula are very close relative to it. And they're going to say, and we apply it, and then we use this, the intensity of light, and we estimate the power, and therefore the acceleration of the electrons, or the force with this. And so they'll have omitted this step where they applied that formula. But now you know what they were doing, which is just applying that simple formula. And so again, many times, people will end up with a formula like this, and then they're going to do some miraculous transformation where they turn the velocity into the mass. And it's just this, which is, you know, 2 times half and squared equal to gm, gm squared over r. That's it. That's all you have to do. And then basically what you have is an estimate of the velocity in terms of the mass, which is really useful. All right. So that means that whenever you want to start estimating things, you don't have to know both the mass and the velocity of what's going on. Oh, there's also a number in, sorry, total mass. So the total mass of the system times the mass of the individual items within it. Right? You'd think, but yes, it's the average of kinetic energy of the part of each particle to the potential that it feels. I was second guessing myself for a second there. This will come back for kinetic systems for thermal systems. The average thermal energy in a gas will also be governed by this, because one of the other useful formulas to know is that the kinetic energy is going to be equal to kT, which is the temperature, depending on how, until you get to really relativistic stuff. Crazy. And so then you have to add another equality here, and so you can turn temperature, you can turn masses into temperature stuff. And so another thing that people will always do, and not play with it going, and it seems mysterious and deep until you know that it is dividing by R. Anyway, so if we use this, we can replace this V here, handily, with GMs and Rs. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, so is that approximation good? Because you're assuming that all the other, this particular star is equidistant to all the other stars.
It's the only skyscale in this system, so it'll give you, this will be factors wrong, but it's okay. If you want to get to that accuracy, then you're not going to use this. But often, very rarely, for this sort of level of just get approximating things, need that kind of accuracy. And lots of times, if you do it the right way, you'll get a 15% or a 10% difference. So just whether you think a week of your life is worth 15%.
So this Verrio theorem, we're using it for systems that are relaxed?
That's a good question, but yes.
So are we now making the assumption that we're going to?
It just means that the system, basically, there's a slight inconsistency there, because we're sort of saying we start with an unrelaxed system, how long does it take to relax? And then this makes this assumption of relaxedness. But the thing is, you don't really, it's good enough. Again, because it can be in a varial equilibrium before it's fully relaxed. This condition, I think you can say, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
This system, this condition will be true sooner than it's fully dynamically relaxed. Like our galaxy is not that, as we're going to discover in a few minutes, our galaxy is not dynamically relaxed. But it's close to real equilibrium. So this sets in a lot sooner than dynamically relaxed. Which would take more time to prove, but. Using this, we can see that delta V squared per passage is going to be given by, so V squared is going to be GM of R, pi over N, GM, full M, log R. So we're almost there. This is almost simple enough to quit. Not quite. Can't quit until it's maximally reduced. I'm sorry. What I really wanted to do is go the other way. So this is true, but what I really want to do is take the GM, V squared, M squared, and turn that into No, it didn't. Okay. So g squared, g m is going to be equal to r b squared. I actually want to go the other direction. You know, that is true, but then I'm going to go straight from here to here and say I over n times r b squared over n. And then I can go ahead and make this replacement that we said earlier in being pi over r squared. And it's again the total number of objects here. And then we're also going to be able to note here that this is a simplifying assumption that basically the so B min, if we assume that, so B min, so here we can also be able to use this for B min. So basically, B min, we put this in right here, or back this, either of these doesn't really matter. We're going to end up with it being n over 2r. Okay? So that means that in the logarithmic ratio, which is r over b min, is about equal to, and just drop the 2, so r over n. Is that right?
Yeah. I think if your formula for b min is the inverse of
that. Oh, did I get the upside down?
Yes, the b is in the denominator.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Just the backwards. Yeah, sorry about that. Right, so this is r over 2, 2 r over n. Yeah, that's better. Thank you. So anyway, so b min is like this. That means that r over b min is really fast n. Another nice thing about this approximation. So we just take log of n, n is the number of items. So canceling out the factors, we end up with basically b squared times 8 log n over n. All right, so that's delta b squared. So how do we know when the system is relaxed or when it's been dynamically relaxed?
There shouldn't be
what? where did I
get my extra?
Oh,
because
where's the extra R go? I forgot to put in the R that comes from extra R go.
I think your first line has an extra R in the numerator.
Which one?
That line, yeah.
Is that one? R in the numerator. Extra R in the numerator, right?
So, yeah. If you substitute it from real theorem, I think you probably get an extra R.
Yeah, so that's right.
I don't see the dollar column on the left side.
Right, so. This is incorrect. So let me just go back to. This is 8 pi b then, right, so if d squared m squared, here we go, equals r squared d squared over m squared, right? That is pointing wrong. So this is going to be 8 pi times r squared d squared over m squared times 1 over, like, times little m over d squared. Yeah, and now it all comes up, right? Because, so we can replace here again, n over pi r squared. This time the r's go away. See, yeah, I just do this to make you people feel better. Again, so this ends up coming out as 1 out of 2. Right. Oh, that's all right. Only a few corrections necessary. Okay, so we're almost done now. So what will be the characteristic sign that these delta V perps have added up to something significant? Did somebody already say this answer? Obviously, because basically, whenever delta V perp is again the order of the original velocities, the average velocity of stars, then we'll know that, you know, all the little changes have added up and completely changed the direction of an average star. So that we can just plug in here. So if delta v is equal to v, then we have t squared equal to v squared times 8 log n over n. But this will be basically, so the delta v times the number of passages, right? So there'll be, so some, you know, there's a counting number, I use a little n and n, v script n. So we'll have n passages to turn this into this, right? It'll take the divided by. So, so the sum over these will be this. So the sum over g squared will end up to b squared. And so that sum goes n delta b squared. And these go away. And so the number of passages it takes to get this to relax will be given by n over 8 log n, roughly. Okay? Now, so what does that tell us? So now we can just take some typical numbers for classical physical systems and ask, have they relaxed? Which is, we need one more ingredient, which is how long does it take to make one passage? And that's easy to estimate. So the time for one passage would be given by, we've already estimated this. There's only two numbers in the problem. R, B, V. We have R here, right?
Yeah.
So R and then velocity, right? So the time for one passage will be this. And so the time to relax will be the number of passages times the time for a passage. So it'll be N R. Or to replace this will be n over 8 log n times r over n. So the time of the passage. But so for a system like, so for a galaxy, the number of objects is about, let's start with the galaxy, and it's something like 10 to the 11 stars in a galaxy. So that means that the number of passages necessary is going to be like, it's going to be like 10 to the 11. I'm going to approximate 8 by 10. It'll be 10 times 11, right? So this is going to be like 10 to the 9 passages. And so the time that it takes a star across the galaxy, so this will be like, so a galaxy is like, the crossing time for a galaxy is pretty, it's pretty short compared to the age of, it's pretty long compared to the age of galaxies, right? Anyway, so the time to cross a galaxy will be the size of the galaxy, velocity, I don't know if we go into all of that right now. But we should probably get back to here. Anyway, the point is that for the age of a galaxy, it is something like 10 years, and then within the it takes about 10 to the 7 years. Across the galaxy. Right, yeah. So the crossing time for a galaxy turns out to be something like 10 to the 7 years. And so that means over its age, it's just like 10 to the 10 years. Something like that. It's had time for about 10 to the 3 crossings, about 1,000 crossings max. And so that means that we're still 6 orders of magnitude away from having an adequate number of crossings for the galaxy to be diameter. So galaxies are not elliptic. What about globular crust clusters? They're just gatherings of stars, self-contained gatherings of stars. They typically have about 10 to 5 stars. And a crossing time, I'll just tell you, of about 10 to the 5 years. So then, so we ask, what's the number for them? Again, it's going to be 10 to the 5 divided by 10 times 5. So about 10 to the 3.5 crossing, something like that. It's very approximate. But then the lifetime of one of these things turns out to be 10 to the 10 years. So these are just as old as galaxies. So since they only need, so their crossing time is 10 to the 5, their lifetime is 10 to the 10. So that means that the number of crossings is also about 10 to the 5. So they had plenty of time up until now to be done after their life. So we'll just keep going. For a cluster of galaxies, interestingly enough. So a cluster of galaxies, so the galaxies are galaxies, not stars. And so in a cluster of galaxies, you have something like 1,000 galaxies. And the crossing time for a cluster of galaxies is huge. It's 10 to the, that's something like 10 to the 9 years, almost the history of the universe. Across that. But because n is sufficiently small, the number of crossings necessary is 10 to the 3 divided by 30. So it's about, you know, a third times, a third of 100, about, so 30 crossings. And so since the age of the universe is about 10 billion years, then there's clusters of galaxies are just now, like an old cluster of galaxies would be just now that there are, just from this dimensional target, or just on the verge of being finite there are. So you can see here that from these kind of arguments, you can look at things and decide if you can figure out some other way there are dynamics that are lax. You can guess things about either their age, their size, or the number of objects in them. So you can see the number of objects in them and their, and see if you see the number of objects, their size, and if their dynamic are lax, you kind of know how old they are, more or less. And vice versa, if you see something that should be, that by its size and number, it should be dynamic or lax, but it's not, you know it's probably younger. So this is a useful way of using all of this information. So any questions on all of that?
Yeah. Comments from there. What does physical mean B minimize? Like this principle B could be zero, but does it mean that we do not consider objects we do not consider collisions close to the another point, which is there is no sense to talk about being perpendicular.
That's a good idea. So we could estimate that. So like if we just take B-man and just say per passing how many of those we get, right? So we just estimate the other rate, which is and just sum the two. So per passing the area inside B-man sort of within going to be about pi b n squared, right? And so what does that mean? So for one crossing, for one star going through, the number of stars that are going to pass within its b n squared, so the number of events is going to be like n times pi b n squared, right? And so this is going to scale as n over pi r squared. This is going to scale as n over r squared. But we also still know that bmn, r over bmn, is about n, right? So this is going to go like 1 over. And so basically, is that right? Yeah. So the number per passing, the number of events that will happen of this kind will be 1 over n. And so that compares with over here, where we ended up with this critical log n. 10 times log n over n. So this is the summing process is a factor of 8 times log n more efficient than the direct hits process. So if you added those together, so if you sum the two, it's going to be like basically sort of like 10 log n over n plus 1 over n. And so unless n is very small, these aren't going to be comparable. This will always be the dominant. This is going to be the dominant factor.
So I think something I should add here is that, well, delta b, the formula that you have, it's not that you cannot have a smaller b, so the formula.
Right, yeah. I should say, yeah. This min dimension is just, this is the only place I can trust this formula, which is right.
Yes. So, and delta b then cannot get larger than b, that's basically because. So there's a maximum to delta b. So the formula is that the delta b increases as 1 over b, or as b gets a smaller one. But then it maxes out at for a smaller b. So that's effectively, it's not really a minimum, it's a cut. Your formula breaks down, so delta b doesn't get larger than the value at b mean. So that's effectively a cutoff.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a good question. Well, I was trying to, that's exactly right. So that you can do it in general and get both effects simultaneously. There's no reason you can't. But it turns out that you don't need to worry about those other ones because they're sufficiently rare that they're actually swamped by the growth solvation. So it's okay. If you just go to B min, if you're good about all the close conclusions, which are strong, you end up getting an answer that's pretty close to the full answer if you did everything. So being in is not, there's nothing fundamental about being there, you're correct. But you don't need to, you know, kind of, you don't need to. Just sort of goes kind of contrary to your intuition, one's intuition.
You can just move my hands.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Other questions? Very good. Great, well, we're almost, we're basically out of time, but I couldn't go earlier today. That's if anyone wants to stay behind and ask other questions. The only other thing I wanted to add is that for question number three, we haven't really covered that. It's supposed to just be, I kind of like that question. And the only extra fact we need to know is we have to cover the flux of energy from the sun given by a constant time Q for many stars, given by A times T to the fourth. So this is the what you're going to need to know, the flux of energy coming out of the star. Scales of the fourth power. Yeah.
So this problem set's due next week?
Yeah.
Do we have to hand it in, or do we just have to present
the problem? I think we'd have you hand it in. So you look somewhere, whoever's presenting. No one's volunteered to do three yet.
I think everybody is handing them in.
Yeah, everyone will be handing them out.
But just one person to present.
Should it be mimetic?
The two throughout the semester will be in test, but only any two that you want. So you don't need to worry about it this week. Or when it, so basically, just some week whenever you're. If you're well versed in LaTeX and you just whip out a couple, the first couple, then you don't have to worry about it. But anyone who hasn't learned LaTeX before, I recommend you actually get started soon. I'll put some sample stuff on the course web page. By all means, you can ask us questions about even these kind of things. Happy to help. It's because it's really, it'd be good just to go ahead and learn and figure it out. Try typing up one, a brief thing or two just to kind of get the idea. I forgot to, one of the question I forgot to ask on the questionnaire is whether people use Mac, PC, or Linux. So maybe I can just get a quick show of hands. Linux.
In the office, PC at home.
PC at home, PC, Mac, any Macs? Okay, so it's a hodgepodge. So we'll, all right, I just wanted to see if like by any chance, we did it with one of my operating system dominating or somebody else. So tech is sort of what Linux native, but there's programs for all the different operating systems. So I'll put links to all, there's free programs for all of them. So I'll put links for that.
Great. Still in the
what?
You're still in the